Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That's right, Dorothy. This is Movie Addict Headquarters. You don't have to be a movie addict to visit here, but if you are one, it's definitely the place for you. I'm your host, Betty Jo Tucker, speaking to you from beautiful Pueblo, Colorado, on this 11th day of August, 2009. Today, we'll be talking about memorable heroes and villains with Jeffrey Hirschberg, whose terrific book about the subject is scheduled for release soon. So it should be a very interesting and fun show. Jeffrey will be with us in a few minutes, but first, let's see if Nikki Starr and Jazz Shaw, who are definitely heroes to me, are ready to get things started. Hi, Nikki. I bet you have some favorite movie or TV heroes and villains. Am I right?
You know I do, and yes, I'm glad to be here. Hello.
Hi.
My favorite hero? Okay, this won't surprise any of y'all, and I wish that AJ was here, but it's Optimus Prime.
I knew. Why am I not surprised that you would be here? I don't think that's going to be one of the heroes that we'll be talking about today. So,
Jeffrey, if AJ's listening, he's going to be like, oh, yeah, you need to hush that girl up.
Well, I do have another question for you. Is everything set up in the chat room? All systems go there.
All systems are go.
Terrific. And we thank you, as always, to taking such good care of our chatters. And I want to thank the chatters for signing in. And, of course, I want to thank all our other listeners for tuning in. And speaking of tuning in, let's find out if Jazz is tuned in to today's subject. Hey, Jazz, have you been thinking about villains and heroes these past few days?
I have, and I thought I was going to be one of the villains, so I was surprised to be introduced as a hero, because now you've thrown off my whole game.
Oh, I'm sorry about that, but you know you are. I mean, we couldn't do the show without you and Nikki, so you are heroes to me, and I have a feeling that one of your favorite heroes that we've already done a tribute to on Movie Addict Headquarters will be talked about in today's program, so I'm going to let you off the hook with that question now.
Yeah, I may surprise you later anyway, so.
Well, I do love surprises, absolutely. And I'm eager to hear from our guest about this subject because he really is qualified to enlighten us. Jeffrey is a member of the Writers Guild of America and judge for the WGA Awards. He's had screenplays optioned by Hollywood production companies. He's written or created shows for Showtime, Lifetime, and ABC. He's worked at Warner Brothers, NBC, ABC, and Viacom, and he is an active screenplay consultant. Jeffrey also is director of the Film and TV Arts Program at Buffalo State College. It's my great pleasure now to welcome Jeffrey Hirschberg to our show. Jeffrey, congratulations on your upcoming book, Reflections of the Shadow, Creating Memorable Heroes and Villains for Film and TV. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you very much for having me. It actually, the book just came out yesterday, so it's available. It's probably too early to do a plug, but it is available on Amazon right now. So,
great. It's never too early to do a plug. That's great. Well, we did put the cover on the Movie Addict Headquarters site, so listeners who are tuned into the site or clicked into the site can check that cover, and it will take them right to Amazon. So I hope that's a help, because I'm certainly encouraging everyone who's interested in movies to order your terrific book. And it is so great to have you with us. You know, while I was reading your book, I realized you belong here, because anyone who names their dog after Alfred Hitchcock must be a movie addict.
Well, and you know, the other dog that we had, and we don't have any more, unfortunately, was named Billy, and he was named after Billy Wilder, one of my heroes.
Well, I think that's better than naming both of your children after movie stars like I did. I mean, we named our son Kelly after Gene Kelly, and we named our daughter Susan after Susan Hayward. So, but I think a dog does qualify, or two dogs qualify you to be to be called a movie addict.
Thanks.
And, you know, we'd love to talk about villains and heroes on our show. So I know Jazz is chomping at the bit there to get the ball rolling. Right, Jazz?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have to stick with the theme. My half of the thing is the villains. I'll let Nikki be the hero for today. So, Jeffrey, give us your highlights of the most memorable villains that you like to look into in your book. And who stands out for you?
Okay, so basically what I did was, you know, there were so many movies to choose from, and it was a couple years ago when I started putting this table of contents together and a book proposal together. I was really sort of floundering. I couldn't really figure out, you know, what villains to choose. So I remembered back in 2003, Arnold Schwarzenegger hosted a show for the American Film Institute on the 100 most famous heroes and villains, and they were voted on by people in the entertainment industry. So I thought that was a good list to go to and select from there. And I wanted, you know, some diversity and some villains and heroes that I thought were really would stand out and really would be memorable. But for the 10 villains that I feature in the book, and this is in no particular order, I didn't rank them, Hannibal Lecter, of course, from Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Lecter, as we refer to him, Darth Vader from Star Wars, the Wicked Witch of the West, which is in line with your Dorothy theme that you opened up the show with, Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Alex Forrest, and a lot of people don't, you know, immediately know who that is, but that was the Glenn Close character in Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, wow.
Gordon Gekko from Wall Street, and actually they're making a sequel to that you've probably read about with Oliver Stone and Michael Douglas again. And I want to have somebody who is very contemporary, because a lot of my heroes and villains tended to be from the 70s and 80s, and I thought the Joker was very deserving of being on the list, the Heath Ledger character from The Dark Knight. Hans Gruber, who is one of my favorites from Die Hard, Stephen D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard, is interviewed in the book. Noah Cross from Chinatown, the John Huston character, who's not in the movie that often, but he's evil nonetheless, and Annie Wilkes, another name that a lot of people don't immediately know who that is, but that's the character from Misery, the Rob Reiner movie. So those were the 10 villains that I wanted to focus on, and, you know, a good selection of, like, you know, genre and time frame, and had to have, you know, I wanted to make sure there were some men and women in the list and so forth. And then I started researching, you know, what are some commonalities amongst these villains that we see over and over again? And I don't know if you want me to get into that, but which I'm happy to do. But that's the list thus far.
That's an interesting set of selections. And Joe, he left my personal number one pick off the list, which was Khan from Star Trek II. But I liked a lot of those. You know, some of those would have definitely made my top five.
Well,
no,
I think it's a terrific list. Yeah.
Yeah,
go
Khan
ahead.
is a great selection. That was and you know, if I do a sequel to the book, I'll have to come up with, you know, 10 of and I can easily probably come up with 10 more heroes and villains, and someone like Khan would probably make the list.
That would be a good one to add, and I'm very impressed with this list. I was happy that you did include some women in the list, and the only one right now that comes to my mind that I would add would be Bette Davis in The Little Foxes, and I've forgotten what her character's name is, but there was a villain, and I just get chills up and down my spine every time I think about that scene where she lets her husband take the, where she doesn't find her husband's medicine, heart medicine, and just lets him die while she watches, and he thinks she's going upstairs to get the medicine, and I just thought that was a terrific scene. But, you know, we've gotten some emails from people who have suggested other villains. Also, Fausta Wirtz, who has her own Blog Talk Radio show, 15 Minutes
with Latin America and who is a loyal listener to Movie Addict Headquarters, sent me an email, and she picked Hans Gruber, played by that wonderful actor Alan Rickman, and
right.
She also picked Darth Vader, but she likes Vincent Price in all his villainous roles, and George Sanders from The Picture of Dorian Gray, which I do not remember. I don't remember that movie other than the picture growing old while the main character stays young. So does Vincent Price make any sense to you, Jeffrey?
Oh, yeah, he makes a lot of sense to me, and I think he's one of those guys that probably played a good villain in a bunch of films, but never a truly memorable villain in one or two films. You know, that's just my opinion. Some people are huge Vincent Price fans and can pick out that one movie where he certainly was memorable, but I don't know if he has that sort of long-lastingness for one particular film. In his body of work, he was a great villain. So.
Yes, and I would like you to take a few minutes and say why you felt these were memorable, these villains were memorable. What does make them stand above the pack?
Well, what I talk about in the book and some of the research I did for Villains and Heroes at the beginning of the book, which is sort of analyzing these 20 movies, and the second half of the book is more like if you want to write a book or if you want to write a movie or if you want to write a teleplay, here are some ways to create your own memorable heroes and villains. But for the first half, one of the things I found with villains is I really wanted to talk about their motivation. Why do they do what they do? Is there a commonality of why villains do what they do? And what I sort of came up with, and of course there are exceptions to this rule, but what I came up with is that most of these villains, at least the ones that I listed and the ones I wrote about in my book, they have this need for legitimacy. They're not comfortable in this world. They want to be legitimate. And what's interesting is, if you think about it, it really, and I don't want to get too political on this, but it really is, it's almost metaphorical to what we consider villainous political leaders now. I mean, if you look at places like Iran and if you look at places like North Korea, these are leaders, leaders of these countries, who really are desiring legitimacy. That's why this whole Bill Clinton thing worked very well, and you know they had photos with a former U.S. president. They're desiring legitimacy. So sort of the political bent aside, I started thinking more and more about it, how art imitates life, which imitates art, et cetera. But more and more, so many of these villains, Hannibal Lecter, you know, he really, you know, yes, he's a cannibal and he's a sociopath and so forth, but he doesn't just want to be free. He wants to be accepted. He wants to be, you know, he desires this legitimacy. The Wicked Witch of the West, we see in the first half of the first act, I should say, of The Wizard of Oz. She wants to be accepted. She wants to be as loved or beloved as the Good Witch by everyone else.
Yeah.
Alex Forrest wants a traditional family in Fatal Attraction. She wants.
Well, I've always thought that The Wicked Witch of the West, by the way, always got a very bad rap and totally undeserved. I don't even know if she qualifies to be a villain. Betty Jo will remember one of the greatest short descriptions of a film in TV Guide that ever appeared was the one where somebody wrote the description of the show as being a young woman arrives in a strange land, kills the first woman she sees, and strikes out with three new friends to kill again. So, you know.
Yeah, right.
That's very funny, and it is true.
That's a good one.
Yeah, there is an element of truth to that. But I will tell you, you know, I have three little boys, and they are scared to death of the Wicked Witch of the West. So on some level, she's a villain, but that description is very funny, and I think there is some truth to that. So anyway, just to sum up, they a lot of these villains, you know, they sort of believe they're heroes in their own story. Most villains don't know they're villains, or a lot of them don't. And then, you know, this sort of need for legitimacy. They want to be known. Even Hans Gruber in Die Hard, he was more of a Fortune 500 CEO than he was a murderer, or at least in his mind he was, with the nice suits and the way he spoke. He was very educated, et cetera.
Yeah, he was a very fascinating villain, I think, and he is the perfect example of the he's sort of wanting respect and wanting to, you know, the outsider wanting to be the insider. I mean, wanting
right.
to be part of the inside. And I think you used in your book this sentence that the villain is a shadowy reflection of the hero.
Right.
And vice versa. Did I misquote that?
No, actually, the book, as you know, is called Reflections of the Shadow, and the way I got that title was I was interviewing David Koepp. David Koepp is probably known to your audience as a very successful screenwriter. He wrote the latest Indiana Jones film, he wrote Jurassic Park, and he wrote the first Spider-Man. And when I was talking to him, I told him I was, you know, struggling with the title. And he reminded me of this really great scene between Belloc, who's the villain in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and, of course, the hero, who is Harrison Ford. And in it, the Belloc says to Harrison Ford, he says, "I am a shadowy reflection of you. It would take only a nudge to make you like me, to push you out of the light." So he's really stating the theme of the book, which is this concept of heroes and villains are often more alike than we like to always acknowledge, that, yeah, they are reflections of one another, and heroes sometimes do very bad things. Indiana Jones kills people in all his films, right, whether it's justified or not, usually justified. But and then on the other hand, you know, villains sometimes do very very nice things in their films, and, you know, especially these memorable heroes and villains who are very three-dimensional. So there is that shadowy reflection, and, you know, I thank David in the book for helping me come up with the title, because I thought it was right on the mark.
And where would our heroes be if there were no villains? Because
that's
no
right. You have to have
nothing to define them. You know?
Right. You have to have the villains to have the heroes. And I loved it when you were giving tips about people who are writing screenplays and hero don'ts and villain don'ts. And one of the hero don'ts is don't make your hero flawless.
Right.
And, you know, the hero should have some flaws, and then also give your villain some semblance of humanity. And I think those are two important things for screenwriters to remember. Before we do move into talking about the heroes, I should check with Nikki to see if there are some other villains who are being mentioned in the chat that we haven't put their names in the pot. Nikki, anything you'd like to share with Jeffrey from the chat?
Hi. Well, we have James Woods fans in there thinking that he is a good villain, James Woods. And also Khan. Everybody was happy with Jazz's suggestion of Khan.
Oh, good. And
then it will definitely make the second book.
All right. You heard it here. we have influence. And I didn't get the name of the first villain.
James Woods.
Yeah, you're just saying James Woods in a number of different
movies.
Oh, I
right.
see. Oh, see,
right.
That he's an
yes.
actor who makes a who
yes.
makes a terrific
someone who plays
terrific
a
villain.
Lot of good villains, yes.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's right. Well, those are two good suggestions. But, well, we should give the heroes some time now. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the memorable heroes that you picked to include in your book and why you picked them, Jeffrey?
Sure. So same sort of process going back to that AFI list. And what I found, you know, just to build some kind of theme around them, just like the villains had a need for legitimacy, as you said, outsiders looking to be insiders, what I found was that most heroes, if you ask yourself the question, why do they do what they do, what I found is their motivation is that they're incomplete characters. That there's something missing in their life. It could be their personal life. It could be something that happened in their history. It could just be something in their psyche. But they go after something. They go after this goal, or they go after the villain, or whatever it is, because something is incomplete in their life. So the 10 heroes that I write about in the book are, again, in no particular order, Peter Parker, Spider-Man, Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, which incidentally had the most votes, believe it or not, in the AFI list.
Right.
My personal favorite hero, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yay, for Indy.
Yep. Hey, he's great. He's very, very goal-oriented. Rick Blaine from Casablanca.
Now who's going to be happy about that, Mr. Jazz?
Oh, Jazz, are you a Casablanca fan?
Oh, yes. And I have
oh, okay. I write a lot about Rick Blaine and Casablanca in the book, so I'm right there with you. Clarice Starling, as we know from The Silence of the Lambs. Rocky Balboa from Rocky, of course. Ellen Ripley, and there's a name that a lot of people might not know immediately, but that was the Sigourney Weaver character in Aliens. That's
yeah.
the second movie, not Aliens, right. but the second one, Aliens.
Where she took care of the little girl, right, Newt.
Right, exactly, and she's showing, and again, that was her incomplete side of her persona, was this idea that, yes, she was a warrior, and yes, she was goal-oriented, and she was very tough, and, you know, had this great, you know, strength about her, but what was missing from her is she had this maternal side, and that's why, ultimately, you know, this character worked, and that really was the theme throughout that whole movie. She became the mother, especially in that final battle scene with the mother alien. Oscar Schindler from Schindler's List. Norma Rae Webster. A lot of people don't know her last name, but that's from the Norma Rae movie. And General Maximus, one of my favorites, and actually his full name is General Maximus Decimus Meridus from Gladiator, the Russell Crowe character. So those are the 10 heroes that I focused on in the book.
Interesting choices. Although you didn't leave out John McClane, I was disappointed, but at least, you know, that movie series made it on the villain side with Hans, so.
Yeah, and you know what? It easily could have been. John McClane's a great hero. He's that everyman who takes on, you know, far more than you think he could. He has a good character arc in the film, and he really changes. He makes up with his wife at the end. He really does everything right, and it's such a great movie, and it's so timeless. I will tell you that, you know, many of these, not these films, but there's a lot of films from the 70s and 80s I show my students or college students, and they get bored immediately. You know, if there's not an explosion or a murder or something within 2 minutes, you know, they start texting, basically.
What is the world coming to?
Well, it's sad, actually. They all have ADD, which I also talk about in the book. But my point is, though, Die Hard, even though it was made over 20 years ago, holds up. They really, really like Die Hard. Die Hard's got a great pace to it, and it's got great, you know, what we would call archetypal characters that really, that are easy to understand, and they really stand out.
And as predicted, Betty Jo, he left Brad Majors off the list, but that's okay.
You'll settle for this list. I'm just delighted with the list, and I like, again, you have the Jodie Foster character from Silence of the Lambs, and you have Sigourney Weaver, and you have Sally Field. I almost forgot Sally Field's name. Sally Field from Norma Rae, and so I think I'm happy about that, because so many times when people are making a list of their favorite heroes, they're all male. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If you look at I don't know the exact number, but if you look at the 50 or so top heroes on the AFI list, it's really, you can count on probably two hands at the most of the female heroes on the list. So it was difficult, you know, finding female heroes on the list, and that's really a reflection of Hollywood more than anything else.
I think so. That's too bad, I think. But hooray for Clarice and Ellen. And Norma Rae. Now, I'm wondering about the chat room and their feelings about heroes. Are there some heroes being mentioned there in film or TV that we haven't talked about? Nikki?
Of course, you know.
All right.
Everybody
All right.
So,
good, I'm glad.
Sam from Lord of the Rings, and Jazz, of course, is arguing with me that I'm not the one that mentioned it, just so you know. Someone else in the chat did. But Sam from Lord of the Rings, and then Jazz thought maybe Aragorn was more of the hero, but I think Sam was a hero too.
I did too.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good choice.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. And then Kathleen Turner, although I'm not really sure which movie, it's Manuel Noriega who's talking about it right now. I'm not really sure which movie he's talking about her in. I can't think of her.
I mean, I'm Romancing the Stone, maybe?
Oh, maybe. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that's a good one.
That was a great movie.
That's an excellent choice. Thank you, Manny. Yeah. That is just great. I had forgotten about that movie, and yet when I saw it, I just loved it, and I thought the role she played was just a wonderful role. So thanks for bringing that up.
There's no animated heroes, I gather that, or villains.
You know,
Darth Vader, nothing.
The the world of animation is so rich with these classic heroes and villains, and I just wanted to keep it just for this book to live-action characters.
Okay.
Although I do mention, you know, movies like Beauty and the Beast and Finding Nemo,
sure,
and you know, a bunch of the Pixar and Disney films throughout the years. There's DreamWorks. I mean, there's a slew of really, really great heroes and villains. But just for the purposes of this book, I kept it to live action. But yeah, there's a lot of great animated ones.
Now, Jeffrey, you already told us where you came up with the title for the book, which I thought was very interesting. But going beyond that, what do you hope to accomplish with the book? What do you want people to take away from this other than just a retrospective of some of the memorable good guys and bad guys?
Well, I think this book, I mean, at least the goal of the book is really for two types of audiences. One type, it's for film aficionados, people like maybe some of you or a lot of people in your audience who just love movies and they love reading about movies and they want to understand more about how movies work character-wise, structural-wise, and et cetera. And I think this book will give people a better sense of, you know, why certain movies are memorable and why they're long-lasting and why people continue to watch them over and over. The other audience for this book are writers, people who want to write, screenplays or teleplays or novels or plays. And my argument in the book is basically, if you could really nail a great hero and a great villain in your story, whatever that may be, you're really going to capture the attention of that reader or that viewer or that audience or whomever it may be. And I also think the book is sort of a good complement to people who already have books on writing, because a lot of, at least film writing, a lot of books on film writing, many of which are very good, are on structure or on how to write the screenplay that sells, et cetera, et cetera. This, I believe, is a complement to any of those books, because there's really not a lot of books out there. There's very few that really focus on heroes and villains. And I keep going back to this theme that if you really nail your hero and if you really nail your villain, and these are characters that, in the case of a screenplay, a movie star would want to play, you're going to do very well. You're going to get the attention of whether it be an agent or a manager or a producer or a studio executive, whomever you're going after, because much of the business is run by movie stars who read scripts and say, call their agent and say, I want to do this, and that's what gets the ball rolling, or a director that reads it. So that's sort of what I want to accomplish. It's sort of a long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah,
well,
and Betty Jo, we have a late entry coming in from the chat that we would be negligent if we didn't say, it has to be mentioned, Marv from Sin City.
Now, are they saying he's a hero or a villain?
Apparently villain.
That's interesting, because I think he had such a sweet side to him. It was great, great role. I mean, great role, great acting, and I really enjoyed that film. But I don't know. I'd have to watch it again. What do you guys think? I think that one can go either way.
I think they're so complex, the characters. It's kind of hard to hang the white hat and the black hat on one person.
Yes,
yeah.
And who was the actor that played that part?
Oh, I can't remember.
I'm blanking right now. The guy who played the lead role in The Wrestler.
Mickey Rourke.
Mickey Rourke.
Exactly.
It was
hard to recognize him because he was heavily, you know, he was in heavy makeup and prosthetics and so forth. But great nuanced role, very layered role. And that's why I question immediately, is he a villain, is he a hero? I don't really know. I'd have to see it again, but I just remember him, it being sort of a love story, wasn't it? I mean, his segment of that film, wasn't it more of a love story?
Okay, now I'm being corrected by the chat. No, they were saying hero, my bad.
Okay, good.
I'm mentally fixated on villains right now, so.
We can't get
Let's
Sans
move
off.
Along, yeah.
We can't get
Sans
off of villains. Well, you can't go wrong by putting Mickey Rourke on one of these lists, or maybe both of them, because he's been
right.
So good in so many movies. And
oh,
I liked what you said about what you want to do with this book. And I thought it's just a wonderful tool for wannabe screenwriters and for those who want to improve their scripts. But most of all, I just loved this little paragraph that I hope you don't mind if I quote, that you wrote about why people should buy your book. Is it all right if I read a little paragraph from your book?
Sure, as long as we run it by my lawyer really quickly.
Okay. Well, I already did before the before the show. Okay. Okay, here's what you said. Why buy it? Is it for everybody? Much as I would like to think this topic garners interest from kids from 1 to 92, the truth is that Reflections of the Shadow is for those of you who bought advance tickets for The Dark Knight, gathered friends together for the season finale of Lost, and still get a chill every time Dorothy transforms from black and white into glorious color. So it is for movie addicts, isn't it, Jeffrey?
I think so. Yeah, I agree with that. Definitely.
And I think you did quite a wonderful job of explaining the elements that you think go into great storytelling. So I wonder if you could take just a few minutes and explain that a little bit to our listeners.
Sure. I have a section in the book called My 11 Laws of Great Storytelling, and this is really targeted more to film, people who want to write screenplays, people who want to make movies, or people who work in Hollywood and who are development executives, you know, or agents or managers, people who read scripts and work with writers. So you're either a writer or you work with writers in Hollywood. And I came up with these, and this is based on me reading literally thousands of scripts over the last, you know, 18 or 19 years, both as a writer and a professor and a screenplay consultant. So the 11 laws, you want me to just read them off real quick?
Sure, please do.
Okay. Law number one is assume everyone has ADD, which basically means that if someone's reading your screenplay, assume they've got, you know, an extremely short attention span. These are people, whether they be a reader or somebody who works for a production company, they're probably reading 20 full-length screenplays a week, literally.
Yeah.
And yours might be the 20th one they read on a Sunday night, so you really have to entertain them quickly, which leads me to my second law, which is spend most of your time on the first 10 pages of your script. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with or worked for or students, et cetera, who have basically said, if this screenplay or this script or this novel doesn't catch me by page 10 or 15, but, you know, around page 10 or so, they're going to throw it out. They're going to pass on it. And if you think about it, most great movies or most movies in general, when you're sitting in a movie theater, when you hit about the 10 to 12 minute mark, you have a good idea if you're going to like the rest of this movie. Either the characters and the story are set up quickly and cogently, and this is something you want to watch, and there's sort of built-in conflict, or it's something you don't want to watch. So it's very important. I'm sorry. Yeah, grab them early, exactly. Number three is write roles to attract movie stars. I mentioned that earlier. Movie stars, they say in the business, get attached. They're called elements, and an element is typically either a movie star or a director. So you want roles to attract movie star. You want to write those roles, and a great hero or a great villain is going to attract a movie star. Number four is write economically, and that's really, really important. We don't need, like, you know, 20 lines of stage direction. And a lot of people who start writing screenplays think in the back of their mind they're writing a novel, but it's a very different art form. You've got to be really quick. You've got to be very economical in the way you write and make sure that that comes across to the reader.
Yeah,
number five is
the director is going to wind up ignoring 90% of what you write in terms of stage direction anyway.
You're absolutely right. So that leads me to, I didn't mention this law, but, you know, as a screenwriter, you don't want to put camera angles in your script or anything like that for the very reason that Jazz just mentioned, that, you know, directors are going to ignore that stuff anyway. Number five, which is related to a lot of the stuff I talk about in the book, is make sure every character has a unique voice. Neil Simon had this sort of famous rule in his playwriting. He said, you should be able to cover up the names in a play, or a screenplay for that matter, and still know who's saying what. Really, really difficult to do. But if your characters are really, really unique, that's the kind of thing you want to, you really want to try to shoot for. Number six is understand your audience. It's really important that you understand, are you writing for males under 25, like the Saw movies, you know, Saw 1, 2, 3, 4, that
yeah.
franchise, you're writing a horror film, or are you writing Julie and Julia, which just came out, it's doing good numbers, and that's more for women over 25. So it's
and not for vegetarians, okay, but go
that's
ahead.
That's right, in fact, or vegans. So it's important to understand the audience that you're writing for. Number seven is know your three-act structure. Whether you like it or not, Hollywood movies are still sort of entrenched in this three-act structure, and more importantly, the first people who will read your screenplays, whether they be a reader or an assistant to a producer, a manager, agent, all they know and all they think about is three-act structure, and I go through that a little bit in my book, but as I said before, there's plenty of great books that talk about three-act structure. Number eight is be aware of theme and keep it consistent throughout your script. This is something that young writers, they mess up all the time, and a lot of bad movies, too, where you sit back and you say to yourself, what is this movie really about? Or what are the filmmakers trying to say? And great movies have great themes. There's a great line at the end of Tootsie where Dustin Hoffman, you know, his character, he's sitting, you know, after he pulls the wig off and everything's revealed, and he's with Jessica Lange, the woman he loves in Manhattan, you know, on the streets, and he still loves her, and she's mad at him because obviously he's fooled her for all this time. And he says, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, he basically says to her, you know, I was a better man as a woman than I ever was being, you know, to a woman as a man. Well, I totally butchered that. But anyway, the idea was he actually stated the theme at the end of the movie, that he was a better man dressed up as a woman than he ever was just being a regular man. And it really took that transformation for him to do that. And if you watch the movie again, that theme is very consistent. And Tootsie, of course, is a movie that is very memorable. Number nine is watch and rewatch successful movies similar to your story or similar to your genre. So what I always tell people, either through my script consulting service or students, I basically say, look, you want to write, let's say, an R-rated comedy, which is very hot right now, take a look at the last five or so that have done well, because that's how studios think. So watch The Hangover, watch Superbad, watch Wedding Crashers, watch 40-Year-Old Virgin. These are films, Knocked Up, et cetera. These are films that have done very well, that are funny, and they have a certain pace to them. They have certain characteristics that are similar, and you want to sort of try to pick up on those things if you're writing that kind of movie. If you're writing a horror movie, watch a bunch of horror movies that have been successful. And this is not to say to copy what you see, and this is not to say to lose your vision on what you're writing, but more and more, this is something that you want to do because the people who are ultimately reading your scripts, they have that as a reference. So if you're writing a horror film, they want to say, God, I hope this is as good as Saw 4 or Saw 3 or whatever. Number 10 is know what your hero wants, which is his goal. What happens if he doesn't get what he wants, which are the stakes, right? And there could be stakes like, you know, if he doesn't do XYZ, the world is going to explode. Those are big stakes. But there's also emotional stakes that if he doesn't get the woman he loves, he'll be heartbroken the rest of his life. Well, those are big stakes too. And you also want to know who or what is preventing your hero from getting what he wants. And that's typically the villain. What is preventing the hero from getting to that goal? What is that major obstacle? And it tends to be the villain. And then the final law of great storytelling, which is so important, at the end of your script, at the end of your story, and this is true for novels or for short stories or for plays, leave them wanting more. And I give several examples of films that just have these great endings where they leave you wanting more. It's sort of like, you know, it's that Roy Scheider moment, you know, in Jaws where the ship is sinking. He's got one bullet left in his gun.
Yeah.
The shark is coming towards him. He's got, you know, that canister in his mouth. He's got 1 second to do it or he's going to die. He says, smile, you son of a bitch. And he just, you know, literally has that shot. And the shark goes to pieces. You know, it's like it's that kind of ending that makes people leave. And it's what people talk about, too, and it's what people remember. They remember those great endings because they really make you feel good as a viewer.
Wow, so what a list.
Those are the 11 laws. Yeah, I'm being a little wordy. But each law I go into, you know, in the book, obviously in more depth.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons that I'm recommending the book, especially to people who want to write scripts and who have written scripts and want to make them better. They can really benefit from your book. And our time is going by so quickly as usual, but even more so today with you, Jeffrey. But I think Jazz has one more question. I think we have time. I think it's about a list. Did you have a question about a list, Jazz?
Yeah, I don't know if we won't have time for a really long, drawn-out one, but with your breadth of experience, can you just give us a taste of, if you had to make your all-time choices of the best movies and TV shows, what would be right up at the top?
Oh, boy, this is hard for me because, you know, I can list about 50, and I know, you know, we can all argue about it when we have, maybe we'll do this at another time. I would say film off the top of my head, and these are, a lot of these you'll see on these AFI lists, Casablanca, you know, one of the greatest movies of all time, so well written.
Okay.
The first two Godfathers, not the third one, first two, no offense to Francis Ford Coppola. Citizen Kane, Midnight Express, a movie that not a lot of people saw in the 70s that Alan Parker directed.
Great film.
Great film. And Oliver Stone wrote it, actually, and he won an Oscar for it. Jaws, which I mentioned, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Broadcast News, which I still think holds up as one of the best romantic comedies. About 20 years old. Fargo, which I still think...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the Coen brothers. I think it's their best film still, and it just is, it's so rich with characters. On the television, I watch less television, so I'm going to go back even in time to some classic TV that I thought was very, that really inspired a lot of other great TV, like The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Honeymooners. I think All in the Family was... clearly, as far as live action, probably the best sitcom ever. Maude, which was a spinoff from that. Cheers. St. Elsewhere, which was just such a fabulous drama. I mean, literally every episode was like a great movie. MASH. The Simpsons, which is celebrating its 20th year, just still holds up as probably the funniest, you know, note for note, pound for pound show on television. ER, especially the first few years. The Sopranos, I loved every year of it. And my current favorite, which I can't wait to start next January for the final season, is Lost.
Oh, hooray. That
oh,
is
me too. Yeah.
So many of my favorites are on your list. And this has to be kind of part one of visiting with Jeffrey Hirschberg, I think, because we are out of time. And I just want to let you know, Jeffrey, that you've been a splendid guest, and we really have learned a lot, and we do need to have you come back for another lesson. Will you do that?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
Yes, if we have an aspiring script writer working on a script in the audience today, so you probably passed on some goodies for him.
Oh, good. Good. Well,
absolutely.
Good.
And do you want? And please just give the URL for your script consulting site.
Yeah, my script consulting site is called 3act.com, and it's spelled out like it's phonetically, TREEACT.com. So it's 3act.com, and I can be reached through the website, or you can just email me at jeff@3act.com. And the book, as we mentioned, is available right now on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, too. And I think it's available right now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble maybe in a week or so, but I know people are buying it right now off of Amazon.com, so
yay.
I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope a lot of people buy it. Thanks so much for visiting with us today, and best wishes for the success of Reflections of the Shadow. It's been such a pleasure having you here. This is
Thanks
Betty
so
Jo Tucker. Well, and we will invite you back because we've got a lot more to learn from you. This is Betty Jo Tucker giving a big shout-out to the folks at Blog Talk Radio for all their support in connection with this show. Special thanks, of course, to Nikki Starr and Jazz Shaw for being my heroes and my super helpful producer and co-host, respectively. Thanks also to our listeners and chatters. We really appreciate your interest and participation. The show would not be worth doing without you. Please come back next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for another lively discussion about movies. In the meantime, please don't forget to check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. Now, to close the show, here's the very talented A.J. Daniels with a song we dedicate to all our Blog Talk Radio listeners.
how much I love you. Then you'd be forced to love me too. If you knew how much I adore you, you'd stay with me and be true.